This is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 7, and today I'm joined by Lee Johnson, who is an assistant professor of philosophy at Rhodes College in Memphis and a graduate of the Penn State University Philosophy Program. Her dissertation was on truth commissions, focusing in particular on commissions in South Africa and Latin America, and in the dissertation, she brings the theoretical framework of Derrida to bear on questions of forgiveness and truth-telling and reconciliation. She's also a prolific and compelling blogger, and I invite everyone to subscribe to her blog, Read More, Write More, Think More, Be More, which I will link to in the notes for this podcast. She's currently working on a manuscript related to what she calls weak humanism, which is what brings her to the podcast today. So it's a real pleasure to welcome you, Lee Johnson, to the Digital Dialogue.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's good to be here.
Great. So maybe you could talk a little bit about this idea of weak humanism. I know you've been working on a manuscript. And and tell us a little bit about what the project is and what brought you to it.
Well, in a sense, this project is really a kind of natural extension of a lot of the work that I was doing on my dissertation. Like you said, I wrote my dissertation on truth commissions, and of course, part of that research, a large part of that research, involves looking into what we now call crimes against humanity or human rights violations and these sorts of things. So I became really interested in this discourse of human rights. And the further I got into it, in particular... from the point of view of the kind of philosophy that I do, which is sort of contemporary European or continental philosophy, I realized that there seemed to be this kind of philosophical problem with defenses of human rights or just a sort of general advocacy of human rights, which was that many of the people, from the kind of philosophical tradition that I'm working in, many of the people are philosophers, are very strong advocates of human rights. I mean, it is a tradition that in which questions of justice and how to constitute the best kinds of polities are at the forefront. So human rights issues are really at the forefront. But with very few exceptions, most of the people working in this tradition are not humanists, or would not call themselves humanists. And there are, of course, lots of reasons, and we can get into that later about why. But largely, this comes from the sort of 20th century critiques of, you know, Enlightenment humanism that tended to try to think of the human being in terms of a kind of essence that was constituted by various capabilities like rationality or autonomy or goodwill or conscience, those sorts of things. And so anyway, in the 20th century, there seems to be a lot of sort of disavowing of that kind of humanism. Well, my concern was, how then do you have a sort of strong philosophical, ideological defense of human rights without some conception of the human to whom those rights, you know, ostensibly obtain, right? So so I went back and started trying to look again at a lot of these critiques of humanism, from feminists, from race theorists, from Marxists, from queer theorists. You know, they sort of come at it from all sides. But I went back and looked at a lot of these, and I started to think that it was really a particular kind of humanism that was being criticized there, what I'm going to call sort of strong humanism. That is, a humanism that's based on defining the human being by virtue of these strengths, like rationality and autonomy and goodwill and, you know, the capacity for deliberation and those sorts of things.
Right.
And so that definition, that sort of strong humanism, tended historically to exclude more people than it included, or it tended to be used sort of nefariously to exclude people from the sort of umbrella of the human race.
Right.
So what I'm trying to do,
the assumption of that sort of traditional standard model is that the human being is the highest form of living being, and therefore, because we allegedly have all these strengths, therefore we have certain special kinds of rights that are ascribed to us.
Precisely. Okay. That's precisely right.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm trying to do is reconstitute, I mean, in many ways, sort of resuscitate a viable humanism, by which I mean a sort of humanism that hopefully is kind of freed of, you know, this enlightenment baggage that later becomes things like, you know, racism and sexism and imperialism and, you know, but to try to resuscitate humanism based not on the strengths that we allegedly share in common, but rather our weaknesses. So things like our vulnerability, our injurability, our interdependence, our mobility and mutability, because for two reasons. One, because I think that actually serves as a more inclusive, that is, a more kind of at least putatively universal umbrella. And that's what humanism was supposed to be all along, right? It was not, supposed to exclude people. But that it is actually sort of a more universal umbrella. But also, I actually think it's a better foundation for defending human rights, because what is human rights legislation really designed to protect? It's designed to protect all these weaknesses, right? I mean, it's designed to protect us where we are vulnerable and where we can be exploited and, you know, oppressed or excluded or all of these sorts of things. So anyway, I'm calling this weak humanism, right? In sort of contradistinction to the strong humanism that we see in the sort of Enlightenment tradition, and which came under such devastating critique in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Right. So, I mean, we talked about this a little bit in email correspondence, and I think it's a really interesting project. I'm wondering what your sort of position is on the question of, I mean, you use the language of foundation, you use this language of sort of grounding or rooting these rights in these specific, let's say, weaknesses, at least on your account. Is there, I mean, what's your sort of feeling about the robust critique of even that kind of grounding strategy, to put it simply?
Yeah. See, I should have an answer prepped for this, because I should have anticipated that you were going to ask this. But I don't. So here's a spontaneous
That's
answer.
That's fair enough.
I mean, I think maybe when I say that what we need is something to sort of ground a defense of human rights or ground a sort of viable humanism, I don't think I really mean sort of grounding in the kind of robust philosophical sense that you mean there. I really am thinking more in a almost a kind of purely strategic sense. I mean, remember, again, my original concern was that, and, you know, it's quite simply, it's impossible to make a sort of legitimate argument for human rights if you are going to deny that there is such a thing as the human, right? That might have rights that ought to be protected. And so it seemed like a very obvious gaping hole in the discourse, that there are so many people that disavow humanism but embrace human rights, right? When I say I'm looking for something to ground a defense of human rights, it may not be as sort of I mean, I'm not trying to sort of return to the origin of the idea here or anything, you know, that kind of like strong. Right.
But I mean, is there a sense of a kind of atomic individual at the core of this on the one hand? And on the other hand, what happens when you do try to establish, even if it's by focusing on the weaknesses, an essence of the human, however weak that essence might be, to the non-human and what we do with that world? I'm thinking about our relationship to the environment and to other non-human living things. So I know you enough to know that you don't want to, that you certainly don't want to.
I like kittens and puppies.
Right.
Dolphins.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, those are separate questions. Let me try to take them in a row here. So to the first question, which is, am I basically dealing with a sort of atomic unit of an individual human? I think absolutely not. I mean, I think this is, of course, one of the one of the major sort of targets of, you know, enlightenment, or like what I call strong humanism, right, is this, you know, ultimately unsustainable idea that we are these sorts of atomic individuals. And I think by focusing on weaknesses, what we do is we see all of these dimensions of human life and human existence that, in fact, are overlooked in at least the sort of caricature that we present of sort of enlightenment humanism, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Or sort of classical liberalism.
Right.
So no, I'm not. I mean, I don't think that. I think once we start talking about the human being fundamentally as being vulnerable or injurable and dependent on others and dependent on an environment, mm-hmm, right, in which he or she lives,
right,
that already there we're chipping away at the kind of isolationism that you find in these sort of atomistic accounts, right, of,
I mean,
human beings.
And there I think you really have a resource to link it to some of the ancient positions. I mean, there I think you have a resource in ancient thinking, because there was not, obviously, as you well know, this atomic individual kind of idea. There was a deep understanding and sensitivity to the social nature of human being, the way the human being is exposed to the tragic dimensions of living and all of that. So that's something that there's plenty of things to criticize about the Greek view of human subjectivity, if we can even speak of subjectivity in that context. Mm-hmm. But so there is, I mean, I think that idea that we are socially constituted, that we are robustly and even ontologically embedded in the world in such a way that we can't, we have to recognize our own interdependence. All of that is, I think, critical and part of what I understand you to mean by weak humanism. Although I think you probably don't have a value judgment, I would assume, in the weakness, because
no,
you wouldn't want to say it's so. Interdependence is a weakness; it's potentially, you know, a great strength too, right?
Right, right, and. Yeah, that's exactly right. And when I say weak humanism, I'm of course not using sort of weak as an adjective for the noun humanism. I'm just saying a humanism based on, you know, what we would call human weaknesses. And I also want to say, just if I could, to return to your question about the essence, mm-hmm, you know, whether or not this is an essence. I mean, I think that's a really tricky question, because on the one hand, I think if I were talking casually, that is exactly what I would say. Like, mm-hmm, you know, that human beings are essentially vulnerable. We're mortal. You know, mm-hmm, we're dependent on one another. We're dependent on the environments, the social and the natural environments in which we live, all of these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like saying that is an essence is akin to, you know, when Sartre says that, you know, man is a freedom, you know, and to say that, you know, the sort of that the human essence is freedom. Well, that's, you're clearly talking about a whole different kind of essence here, right? I mean, we're not talking about a sort of static quality that, you know, that that one might say, well, this human being possesses, but that human being doesn't, right? Like we might have said of rationality.
But maybe you could talk more about why some appeal to a kind of essence, however you want to define that, mm-hmm, is necessary for grounding or for this whole project of making sure that what we should be concerned about is human rights and making sure, mm-hmm, that we're treating each other well and with an eye toward justice and all of the things that we'd like to be to think that we're doing with one another, or like to advocate as philosophers that we do with one another. What is the positive side of the essence question?
Well, the simple answer to that would just be a sort of matter of identification, right? That if we're trying to identify a protected group, right, or at least a group that to whom we want to give protections, and, you know, to distinguish, and we don't want to merely identify that group by, or at least we tend not to want to merely identify that group by sort of strictly natural or natural scientific criteria, right? To say, well, you know, we are a species that, you know, that we can define sort of scientifically in this way. And so then anyone who fits that, then we will, you know, accord those beings human rights. Because then, of course, we get into all these problems with you know, end of life issues and before life issues, and you know, when is a human being a human being? And, mm-hmm. and I think we do want to sort of have this more robust, as you say, sort of ontological definition of human beings. As you know, my sort of specialty is sort of Derrida and deconstruction, and I have a natural allergy to, you know, essentialist language. Right. And so, you know, when I say that what we share in common, if there is some kind of essence that we share in common, and again, this is another sort of motivation for a sort of positive side of identifying these sorts of things, is to establish this commonality. Mm-hmm. But if there is something like essences that we share in common, that they're sort of very special kinds of essences, right? I mean, and I would definitely not want to talk about them in this, you know, in sort of Aristotelian terms. Mm-hmm. Although I don't know, because there's a part of me that does sort of think that our mortality and our vulnerability and our interdependence are sort of essential to human existence in that kind of really classically essential sense. But
well, would you be open to the vocabulary? I mean, somebody like Arendt tries to get around, and even Heidegger to some degree tries to get around this sort of talk of essentialism with Heidegger, it's this existentialia, and with Arendt, it's this notion of conditions, the human conditions. Yeah. And, could you get the same rooting, I would like to use the naturalistic vocabulary of rooting rather than grounding or rather than founding. Could you still root certain kind of human rights in that kind of a talk and be more descriptive, perhaps phenomenological about it, rather than mm-hmm. having to go to the essential vocabulary?
Yeah, and I would certainly be more inclined to those sorts of approaches. Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm definitely going to try to avoid making essentialist claims in that sort of sense as much as possible. I think that for me, it's interesting that you mentioned both Arendt and Heidegger. Those are two philosophers, you know, for whom I have a tremendous amount of respect but a considerably less amount of affection. But I do think you're right that they are also trying to dodge this philosophical problem in much the same way that I'm trying to dodge it. I personally like the way Sartre does it. I mean, I really still have this, I really still believe that chapter in Being and Nothingness, the Bad Faith chapter, is one of the most intuitively true accounts of human consciousness that I've ever read. And I like this sort of idea that he uses, which is a kind of meta stability, right? That we're always sort of going back and forth between, you know, transcendence and facticity, and that it is the sort of constant instability, or you know, he calls metastability, of that dual existence in a way, you know, that dual existence that is sort of unique to reflective beings, or at least we believe to be unique to, you know, reflective beings.
Right. So, I mean, what happens on your account then? So let me play some of my own cards. So I definitely buy into the whole idea of humanism. I've been criticized for advocating a kind of humanism, which, from my perspective, the critique is really about anthropocentrism rather than humanism. I'd like to try to retain something of a kind of humanism, but I do worry about what happens when we use that vocabulary of humanism, because it, by defining a group, we've excluded certain kinds of other groups, namely non-human animals and even nature in a certain kind of way. So we need to be careful about that, as you are. I do agree that we have that to be human involves some peculiar sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And so I think we are in a very, very unique kind of situation, caught between, to put it in kind of Greek terms, caught between the omniscience of the gods and the incapacity to deliberate about the future of what the Greeks would call the beasts, right? But
right.
And so I think there's something to be said about that. For me, part of the issue is the question of responsibility. And I know you certainly have some views about that. It seems to me that part of what we want to be thinking about is how are we taking responsibility for the peculiar situation in which we're in.
Right.
As beings who are aware of our death and who have a way of looking toward the future and who even can ask the question, are we treating one another correctly, well? Are we treating one another justly? And are we treating the animals and the other living things around us? Are we treating our world with an eye toward justice? So that's how I would get it towards sort of this question of what I would see as kind of Socratic way of thinking, which mm-hmm. is not necessarily this appeal to these static essences, but these ideals that call for us to ask these questions. Well, what is just in this situation? What is good in this situation? And then have that be not something dogmatically established, but open for dialogue and something that we come to agreement or that we decide in a certain way how to respond to in the context in which we live. And I think for that, you don't necessarily need a rigid conception of justice, nor do you need a rigid conception of the essence of the human
mm-hmm.
to have that sense. But so now there's a lot there. So,
yeah, well, I really, and I mean, there is a lot there. And I agree with a lot of it. And I think if I'm hearing you right, and you can correct me, of course, if I'm wrong here, but if I'm hearing you right, this is the element of what you just said with which I totally agree, which is that there, one of the things that we do when, or at least some of us do when we do philosophy is we attempt to find the best ways, what we think are the best ways to cultivate the best kinds of thinking, mm-hmm. right? And I think that there is a sense in which what we then think about is a subsequent question, mm-hmm. right? And so I think that the work that I'm doing right now, or at least what I'm trying to do with this weak humanism stuff, mm-hmm. is really sort of try to kind of reorient what it means to think ethically and to think politically.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, with that reorientation or that newly oriented approach, then one has to decide, what are the important questions that I take up? Is the important question that I take up global hunger?
Right.
Is it torture?
Mm-hmm.
Is it animal rights?
Mm-hmm.
Is it global warming? You know, I don't know.
So talk more about what this reorientation.
I don't think you can do them all at once, though.
Right.
And so I think that I get this question a lot, and I think it's a completely fair question, which is I start to, the moment the word humanism comes out of my mouth, people ask me about animals and trees, right? And I want to say, you can't do it all at once. You can't answer all the questions at once. What I'd like to think is that the work that I'm doing is not painting myself into a corner where later I can't take up those questions in a way that I feel is analogously responsible to the questions of that I am taking up, questions about, torture and crimes against humanity and, global poverty and hunger and those sorts of questions, which are human questions.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the ones that I'm dealing with. I'm not dealing with questions about the environment or about non-human animals.
Right. But I mean, there's a way in which you could answer. I mean, could we imagine a kind of response to that, saying, look, I am not a tree, and nor am I an animal, right?
Yeah.
I'm thinking from my place, from my position, and that's why I'm thinking about humanism, what it means to be human, what it means to be the kind of being I am. And from there, you're right, you're exactly right, I think, that you can then move out to the question of, well, how are we in relation to the environment, in relation to other animals, in relation to one another?
Right, and again, just to give a little history of why humanism, came under such attack in the 20th century in the first place is because, what I earlier was calling strong humanism, kind of enlightenment humanism, began from a place that it seemed like when those later questions came up, they were all answered quite badly,
right?
So how do we deal with the natural world? How do we deal with other cultures? How do we deal with non-human animals, that we tended to have this very sort of imperialistic or colonialist kind of mindset about what we were as moral or political or natural beings.
Right.
And so when those later questions came up, you know, of course, you know, some of us would say they were answered quite badly. Mm-hmm. So the idea here is to try to reconstitute a humanism that might answer those later questions better. And I think this would, because I think it requires a real paradigm shift to begin to think about oneself in terms of one's weaknesses and needs, you know, as opposed to one's strengths. I mean, I think, you know, just a sort of recommendation to your listeners that Judith Butler's book Precarious Lives is just such a perfect example of what thinking like that looks like.
Okay.
Just such a fantastic book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the one of the things that is really interesting from my perspective about what you're talking about is that you are able, I think, to then delineate certain kinds of characteristics and of what it is to be human. From this perspective of weakness, or this perspective of, I mean, I still am a little,
you still want me to talk about animals? I know you.
No. I don't care
about the puppies.
No, the issue is weak versus strong, because there seems to be, or at least traditionally understood, there's a normative connotation to to that vocabulary, and you probably want to play on that and play off of that. But because I certainly wouldn't want to say, you know, because I'm vulnerable, that is a weakness as opposed to a strength. I mean, it could be a part of the strength of human beings. In fact, you know, when we were talking about last week about the Protagoras, and in the Protagoras, Protagoras gives a kind of account of the origins of human beings, and it's a kind of a very unorthodox account if you look at some of the other stories that are told about that. And one of the things that he articulates there is that it was because of a certain kind of, there was no more goods to give human beings at the time of when Epimetheus came to the end of his attempt to give out goods to all the living creatures, and they gave animals the capacity to run really fast, and others claws and fur and all, and human beings had nothing, so Prometheus had to come and give them certain kinds of intellectual capabilities and other things. So there is a long tradition of this notion of kind of weakness, and that goes back that far. Or weakness in the sense of vulnerability and a peculiar kind of situation humans find themselves in. And maybe one might argue that it's an overreaction to that vulnerability that causes us to posit ourselves as the best and the strongest and think of all of the natural world as at our disposal.
Right.
And I agree with you completely on that. But I wonder, could we get a little bit more on what are those characteristics? So I have the idea of interdependence, a certain kind of vulnerability. What are the other characteristics that you would associate with this with weak humanism?
Well, I think that there are. Let me back up for just one second and say that you said you know that. You would consider vulnerability a kind of strength and not a kind of weakness, and certainly I think that I'm entirely sympathetic with that insight. But surely you would be unusual in saying that, right? And certainly if I had removed you by extraordinary rendition from your office and had you, you know, sort of somewhere tied up and was trying to exploit that vulnerability, you would not consider it a strength then, right? And I think it is, so it's those things. It's those things that can be exploited when someone else brings that kind of vulnerability, and there are lots of them, right? There are physical vulnerabilities and psychological vulnerabilities and social and economic and all sorts of things. But when someone brings that to the fore such that it comes to sort of dominate your existence, right? It's at that point that none of your strengths can help you, right?
Right.
Only some other human being can help you, right? And I mean, this is of course what human rights legislation is about.
Right.
That's what it's for. It's to say, look, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this could happen to any of us, mm-hmm. and so we have these. We have these protections in place, right, for when the weak and the weary can't help themselves, we know that we ought to go in and help.
Right.
And so I think it's those kinds of all of the and that can be weaknesses, like actual physical weaknesses, like, you know, our ability to experience things like hunger and pain,
mm-hmm.
but it can also be just sort of capriciousness, right? I mean, that's a sort of weakness of human beings that we need others. We need to sort of be embedded in social and political worlds,
mm-hmm.
Such that we're not completely at the mercy of our own capriciousness or the capriciousness of others. So.
Right.
I mean, just to pick a kind of more mundane weakness, I think.
Well, no, I mean, but I think then, and I think you're exactly right, and I have a better picture now after that of your concerns. I think that's right. I think your concerns are really important, and I think related then to this, or a core dimension of this, has to be the notion of the human being as essentially a political or a social animal,
mm-hmm.
Right? So that... what you're talking about is because we are exposed in a certain way and vulnerable in a certain way, we require one another to be with each other in a certain kind of way, a way that imagines what it's like for the other, and in a way that can step in when it's necessary. And that's why, in fact, in some ways, I think an issue that's at stake here is the question of responsibility, because one needs to think about the implications of what one is doing at all times and how that's affecting others of us, because we are so intertwined.
That's absolutely right. Could not agree more. I mean, it is ultimately I like you probably don't make such a sharp distinction between the sort of the ethical and the political, but in this instance particularly, right, no distinction
right.
at all.
Right, exactly. Yeah. No, I'm in agreement with that. I'm fine with no distinction or with little distinction. Well, particularly if you have the notion
of spelling distinction.
Right. Especially if you have the notion of the notion of ethics that I'm operating with is always from that kind of Greek perspective of character and the cultivation of dimensions of character that are mm-hmm. That are inherently how we come to those characteristics are always, you know, through education and through our interactions with others. So it's always, you know, that distinction between the ethical and the political is always much more blurry than people, I think, would want to normally say.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, this has been a great discussion, Lee. And
yes, it has.
Thank you so much for being on the Digital Dialogue. And I look forward to maybe in a future episode having us to talk about your use of blogs in teaching, because I know you're doing a lot of that there at Rhodes College.
Yes, and thank you so much for having me, Chris. And again, I want to commend you on doing these digital dialogues. It's a fantastic idea, and you're a really generous interlocutor. So I really appreciate the invitation.